Log Talk Radio. Log Talk Radio.
Doing, brother? Assalamu alaikum. Walaikum salam, I'm well. How about yourself?
I am doing good, Dr. Wesley. We also have Sister Gitch, our host, and we have Mr. Dr. I'm sorry, Boulevard. Who are you, bro?
Assalamu alaikum, Dr. Wesley.
Walaikum salam, how are you?
I'm feeling good like a winner should.
Praise belongs to Allah. That's what's up.
Okay, guys, well, we're ready to rock and roll. So, forget it, where you at?
I am right here, and I would like to extend the greeting to you, Brother DJ Black Caesar, and to our listening audience, and, of course, to my distinguished panel, Brother Vernon, and, of course, Dr. Wesley. Assalamu alaikum. All right. I see that we have a lot of callers on the phone, but before we get started, I would like to acknowledge, if we can get him on, our founder of Nation Building, our CEO and director, Brother Rakeem Khalik Muhammad. Are you there, Brother Rakeem?
Yes, ma'am. I'm here, and I'm loving this show already. Assalamu alaikum, family.
Walaikum salam,
sir. I know you have something to say, so let's just go ahead.
I don't know what to say. I got so many things going through my head right about now. First of all, I would like to say, Dr. Wesley, assalamu alaikum, brother, and thank you for coming on to the show.
Walaikum salam. Thank you for having me, Brother Rakeem.
Yes, sir. We appreciate you, brother. Brother Vernon, assalamu alaikum, black man.
Yes, indeed. Walaikum salam, my brother. Good to hear your voice.
Good to hear your voice also. And to my big cousilla, my big cousin, DJ Black Caesar, the engineer of the show, the superb world-renowned DJ, DJ Black Caesar.
What's going on, cuz? You know what it is, baby. It's all good.
Oh, yes, sir. Yes, sir. Yes, sir. I thank you, sir, for doing such a wonderful job. And my big sister, Gidget. Sister Gidget, I'm telling you, sister, you work miracles. I mean, if Jesus was on the planet right now, just making the blind see the deaf hear, you'd be right with them doing the same thing. Actually, Sister Jesus still with us. He with us today.
Absolutely.
That's another story. I'm sure the listeners enjoying Sister Gidget's, magic. I mean, the miracles that she brings to the Nation Building family when she brings distinguished panelists on the air, live and in person, across the airwaves around the world, just to get you doing such a wonderful job. Sister, I cannot thank Allah enough for you.
Well, thank you, Brother Rakeem, for allowing me the opportunity and for the faith and trust that you put in your big sister. And I promise I'll do my best not to let you down or our nation down, because we are all representatives of the Honorable Minister Louis Farrakhan, and we want to represent in the most excellent way as possible. So I thank you,
yes,
brother,
ma'am,
for the opportunity. And we're going to get started. And, Brother Rakeem, thank you for coming on and of course, welcoming Dr. Wesley. And, Dr. Wesley, what I did not tell you is that I want to welcome you to the Nation Building family. And, you know, once you come on here, you can't just come on here one time. So you do have to come back.
I will have that. I love it.
Yes, sir. Okay, we're going to get started. We have a lot of callers on the phone, so let your sister quarterback this thing. I know as Dr. Wesley begins to speak, you're going to have questions. We are going to take your questions. Brother Vernon and I are going to ask Dr. Wesley some questions that we hope are relevant to you. We are going to get to your questions because I know it's a lot of you out there. Thank you for listening. So we're going to get started. In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful, I bear witness that there is no God but Allah, and I bear witness that the Honorable Elijah Muhammad is his messenger, and I further bear witness that the Honorable Minister Louis Farrakhan is their divine reminder in our midst today. I would like to greet the listening audience as well as my distinguished panel and our engineer, of course, and our nation's greeting words of peace. Assalamu alaikum.
Wa alaikum salam.
Dr. Wesley Muhammad.
First, let's get you, Muhammad. Yes, ma'am.
I want to tell you, I want to share a brief story. I shared with Brother Jamil. I called him about 5 o'clock in the morning. Yes. I called him about 5 o'clock in the morning, and I said, Brother Jamil, I say, Dr. Wesley agreed to come on the show, and I am so intimidated by him. I've been studying the extractions of the Hadith and Bukhari and everything, and I'm saying I still don't know what to ask, you know, Dr. Wesley. And so he said, you know, just ask him this, thus, and so. And so, pardon me, and so what ended up happening, of course, Dr. Wesley, you know I called you. And the first thing he said to me, he said, Sister, I'm your brother. And that just eased it all for me.
Yes.
So I want to thank you for being so gracious and so warm, Dr. Wesley.
No, the honor is mine. I'm thankful to be on your show and to have a few moments to dialogue with you, your distinguished panel, and your listening audience. And I have to give a big shout out to my big brother, Brother Jamil Muhammad, a light of the nation, one of those whom I looked up to as I was growing up as a young Muslim. So it's an honor to have such a mutual friend as Brother Jamil, Big Brother Jamil Muhammad. Assalamu alaikum,
oh,
Big
absolutely.
Brother, if you're listening.
Yes, sir, and I'm pretty sure he is. He's listening. Okay, so Dr. Wesley Muhammad, you hail from Detroit, Michigan,
yes,
and
ma'am.
You are a graduate of Morehouse College in Georgia, and
yes, ma'am.
You're a single father of two, and
yes,
that
ma'am.
Is amazing. And, brother, I commend you for taking on, well, you know, I know it's your nature, but, you know, it's just so rare that we hear fathers who are actually raising their children. So we commend you, sir, for that. But I'm going
to
let you tell the rest of your story. Go ahead and give us some more information about you that maybe we don't know.
Well, you actually disclosed the most important, besides being a believer in Allah, His Christ, and His apostle in this midst. My most important work is in the nation and my home with my children. My greatest successes have come as a father. So most don't know that you came right with it and put it out there. I'm not mad at you, but that is my greatest work is with my children. Other than that, yes, I did attend Morehouse and got a bachelor's in religious studies. I went to Morehouse thinking I'm going to study law and become a lawyer. But while there, I had the fortunate happenstance of being blindsided by the teachings of the Most Honorable Elijah Muhammad. I fell in love instantly and instantly changed my major from pre-law to religious studies to study this teaching officially, formally, and basically because I couldn't get any of my pre-law assignments done because I was caught up studying the teachings of Honorable Elijah Muhammad. So I said, well, let me make it easy on myself. And since I'm studying this teaching all day, every day, anyway, and not getting my schoolwork done, let me find something that will allow me to study this teaching as schoolwork. So that's what I did. I switched to religious studies. I went on to University of Michigan, did Islamic studies. With that, I'm here using what Allah blessed me to get there to help the Honorable Minister Louis Farrakhan raise the dead nation, inshallah.
Yes, sir, and you have a wonderful reputation amongst our believers, and you do wonderful work. I had the pleasure of reviewing some of your YouTube videos, and you are one passionate brother. That's all I'm going to say.
Praise belongs to Allah. Yes, ma'am. That's an accurate assessment.
Yes, ma'am.
Yes, sir.
Yes, ma'am.
Okay, well, what we're going to do, I'm going to ask you some questions, and Brother Vernon, who is also a part of our Nation Building Network family, he hosts a show on Sunday afternoon called No Romance Without Finance, and it's really like an economic development show. He's going to ask you some questions, because the questions that he has for you, Dr. Wesley, I couldn't even remember how to ask them. They were in-depth and so detailed. So I said, Brother Vernon, you know what? You just come on and ask him yourself.
Well, I'm honored
to dialogue
with Brother Vernon. I'm honored to dialogue with Brother Vernon.
So my first question to you, Dr. Wesley, is you know, I understand your passion, and we're going to talk about your up-and-coming Truth Institute later on in the show. But the first thing I want to ask you is that in your research, what did you find as the origin of our history?
Oh, yes, ma'am.
That we're not getting in this dumbed-down, substandard educational system that we have now. What did you find?
Yes, ma'am. Well, actually, I made a very interesting discovery, and that is the true history of the black man won't be disclosed in any history course, actually, whether that history course is at Morehouse or at Harvard, whether that history is being taught by a white professor or African-centered professor. Actually, to get the true history of the origin of the black man, you have to study, you have to take a religious course, because the origin of the black man is the origin of God. And I often say African history or black studies is asymptotic knowledge. You remember in algebra class when we learned about the isomtote, that line on the graph that approaches, what is it, the x-axis, and it gets ever so close to it, but it never crosses, it's never tangent. It endlessly goes on, but it never crosses the threshold of that x-axis. African history or black history or any history that doesn't address the question of who is God bequeaths to us an incomplete knowledge of self. Knowledge of self is knowledge of God. So the fact of the matter is, you want to understand the history of the origin of the black man, you have to study the history of God himself. And the irony is, the origin of God was a topic that we as a people had written about all over the ancient world, and we told the exact same story about the origin of the black man, i.e. God. And further, ironically, the exact same story that was told in ancient Egypt or Kemet, that was told in ancient Sumer or Mesopotamia, told in ancient India, told in ancient China, the exact same story of the origin of the black man, the origin of God, is the very story that the Most Honorable Elijah Muhammad is teaching us in Message to the Black Man. And so that's what put the fire in me, the passion, learning how everything, the science of everything in life, bears witness to the truth, bears witness to the truth of this teaching. It's not only inspiring, it's impassioning. And so, yes, for me, the greatest discovery is that, in fact, to learn the history of the black man, you have to step out of the history courses and step into the religious studies courses.
Yes, sir. Wow. So I'm going to ask this question. Then I'm going to let Brother Vernon ask a question, because I know that you touched on this subject, and I just didn't really get a chance to review all of it. If you could just give us a brief synopsis on the complexion of black people, because that is something that I've often had to face in my family. You know, we have them, where they blacken in 14 midnights, and some of them are white as snow, and we have all this division about our complexions. And so we know that me being a, you know, partially my roots are in Kenya, I have cousins that are African completely. And, of course, coming here, our DNA has been compromised. And so if you could, just give us a brief synopsis on the variations of complexions within that black gene, because
yes, ma'am.
I want people to understand the origin of it all prior to Yaqub.
Yes, ma'am. Well, and that's where we must go. The symphony of complexions, if you will, that characterizes the black men and women in America, we have the whole spectrum. That's one of the beauties of our nation here in America. It is important that we recognize, however, that this symphony of colors that defines our blackness is not just a characteristic or a result of our being corrupted by a slave master seed. This symphony of colors is a characteristic of us as, what the Honorable Elijah Muhammad rightly said, the Asiatic black man, by which he meant the black man is indigenous to every part of the planet Earth. Everywhere you go on Earth, everywhere the European travelers and voyagers went on the planet Earth, they found the indigenous black men and women. Like dialects, the Honorable Elijah Muhammad taught us that no people can speak the exact same dialect in the various regions of the world, because dialect is determined by climate in the various regions. So the black man and woman across the world, we had a singular language, but we always had regional dialects by virtue of the fact that we populated all of the regions. You also find that we not only had regional cultural differences as the Asiatic black man, but we had phenotypical physical feature differences. The black man in India, for example, jet black, as you said, 114 midnights, some of the blackest people on earth, but they don't look like that Kenyan in Africa. The so-called Dravidians of India have thin nose, thin lip, wavy head, whereas, for example, in West Africa, among the Bantu-speaking nations of West Africa, they have the so-called broad features, broad nose, broad lips. Now, not only are regional differences reflected in culture and phenotype, but also in complexion. For example, the Bantu or so-called Bushmen of Central Africa, they are actually a very yellow hue. They look, you put a so-called Bushman next from Africa next to a Dravidian from South India, that Bantu would look like a white man in complexion because he's so pale in comparison to that jet black Dravidian. You have, for example, in Arabia, you have blackness that has a hue of red to it. You have blackness, some blackness that has a hue of green to it. So the fact of the matter is, the symphony of colors, if you will, the symphony of complexions, is a signal to the world that the black man is the origin of it all. All of the world's complexions reside in the genetic makeup of the black man and woman and reproduce the catalog of colors, not just here in America, reproduce this catalog of colors across our planet once called Asia.
Yes, sir. Okay. Wow. Okay, Brother Vernon, I'm going to give you an opportunity to ask Dr. Wesley a question.
Wow, brother. I wasn't expecting the handoff so soon. I'm sitting here just anxious to drink so much of this wisdom in. I want to I'm not one for pomp and circumstance, brother, but I must, I'll be remiss if I didn't tell you that it was an honor to be on the show with you. Certainly, I don't look
mine,
at this.
Brother Vernon. The honor is really mine, beloved.
All praise is due to Allah. This is most certainly not a panel discussion. I'm just here co-hosting with Sister Gidget. Let's get that straight. One of the most,
yes, ma'am. Yes, sir.
One of the most beautiful things about these teachings and about this body of wisdom that that the Honorable Elijah Muhammad delivered to our people throughout North America and throughout the world and introduced to us was something that I heard in the way I was introduced to it. The brother who kind of sparked me and, you know, gave me a little bit of insight said, man, this is some good stuff. It'll make you more intelligent. It'll make you a master of mathematics, and it'll expand your vocabulary. I was so
He never lied.
I was that, when I looked at that, I'd never heard or seen anything like that coming from black people or centered around black people. So when I had a chance to come in contact with it at a later date in my life as an older brother, it really just felt so natural to put that on. And then on top of that, to come across your path now to see that someone has taken that and not just said, oh, yeah, the black man is God and the science of everything in life and use the best of intelligence, but you stepped out there and you really did make that word bond. You put yourself on the line, stepped outside of a comfort zone. And that's a wonderful example that many more of us need to follow and walk in those same footsteps. So I thank you.
Thank you
for representing the way you represent and doing what you do.
Thank you for your words, Brother Vernon. Thank you very much.
All right. Now let's get down to business, brother.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir.
The question that I have, and I don't want to necessarily skip around, but, you know, I came as soon as Sister Gidget told me that I would be on with you. One of the questions and things that I wanted to ask you, I guess I'll go down the list since, you know, the topic is the history of the original man, the Asiatic black man. As it relates to what you learned about the origins of the black man from studying Islamic history.
Yes, sir.
You know, here in America and, you know, in our sojourn ever since the Honorable Minister Louis Farrakhan has stood up to rebuild the work of the Honorable Elijah Muhammad, some of his staunchest opponents have been black people in America who follow what you call the Aryanized, watered-down version of Islam as it's been spread throughout the world. And we know that that is totally devoid of the actual true history of us, our people. So would you share some of what you actually learned in your studies from the Hadith, from Islamic studies, on exactly who we are and why we're here?
Yes, sir. Well, praise belongs to Allah. You are correct, Brother Vernon. The Islam of the Muslim world today is what I call Aryanized Islam. It's that Islam that has been corrupted by white supremacy that was brought to it 200 years after the Holy Prophet, peace be upon him, was among us, brought to it, this white supremacy, by non-Arab converts to Islam, largely Persian, and they brought their, when they converted to Islam, they converted Islam to their way. And this is the Islam of the Muslim world today, which is why we in the Nation of Islam, we have a distinct Islam. We are not beholden to the Islam of the Muslim world, because that Islam is not the deen of the Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him. The Master Farah Muhammad, Allah in person, put the Honorable Elijah Muhammad on the deen of Prophet Muhammad, but with a higher understanding of that deen and with a greater revelation that even he had. Now, regarding the history of black people in Islamic tradition, well, it starts with the history of the early Ummah.
the history of the early Muslim community, that was a black ummah. And it was not an accident that Prophet Muhammad's birthday, Ismailid, was in Black History Month this year. The fact of the matter is that the early rise of Islam, the early spread of Islam from one corner of the earth to the other, was a glorious episode in black history and must be treated as such. In fact, I've documented that the Muslim conquest was the greatest display of black power the world had seen since Hannibal's defeat of Rome. Those Muslims who were attracted to the call, la ilaha illallah, and spread that conquering the known world, those were black folks. Those were Africa, those were black Arabs, descendants of Africans who had migrated to Arabia millennia prior and had indigenized in Arabia. So the early rise of Islam is a glorious episode in global African history, or black history, if you will. And so by studying that early period, you are studying black history. You are studying a critical aspect in the history of the black man within the last 6,000 years. In fact, it can be argued that that moment in time was prior to 1930, the most significant event in black history in the last 6,000 years. Now, I'm bracketing the time period purposefully. There were greater displays of black genius, of black godhood prior to 6,000 years ago. But during this dispensational time, during the time of the rule of Satan, the time of the rule of Yaqub's people, that is to say the time, the era of white supremacy, there has been no more glorious episode in black history than the rise of Islam in Arabia and its conquering of the known world. Lessons in it for us, and lessons in the overthrow of that black power movement and its loss of power and how it morphed into what we have today. We, the Nation of Islam in the West, the Ummah in the West, can learn a great deal, not just about the rise of black Islam initially, but the fall of black Islam. Because, though we don't want to admit it, we are capable of making some of the same mistakes and having the light of Islam that has now risen or is rising in the West. We can make some of the same mistakes that dimmed that light. Our light is currently rather dim. And so the Honorable Mr. Louis Farrakhan said we flatline. Well, some of the same reasons can be cited.
Yes, sir. And go ahead, Brother Vernon.
All right. I was going to, you know, since you bring that point up, and since we're talking about the history, it's been quoted many times, a hadith or a saying of the Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, that if I'm saying it correctly, incorrectly, please do correct me, that Islam would stay intact and his community would stay intact for three generations, but after that time, it would be no more. And the people who quote that and explain that and expound on that use it to say that, yes, there would come a certain point where people would drift away from what it was that really kept Islam and what he established, the Ummah that he was building and planting and cementing in place. It would come to a point where they would really get away from that and lose much of what the purpose and integrity of the movement
was. Absolutely.
What are some of those things those factors that you can point to where you can say, well, that was a deviation. That way they went, that's where they stepped away or lost their power. You know, what can we look to the history for to say, let's not make
that mistake? Yes, sir. Absolutely. The Holy Prophet said three generations after him would no longer be of him. And he ain't never lied.
The three generations of which he speaks, and it's, I'm glad you raised that hadith, Brother Vernon, because it helps us to see this process very easily once we're able to put the flesh of details on the bone of that hadith. The three generations of which he spoke, the first generation was the generation of him and his companions, the Sahaba. The next generation would have been a generation of what they call the Tabi'een, or the successors to the companions, those who were taught by the companions. The third generation is what we call the Tabi'een, the successors to the successors. That generation that was taught by those who were taught by the companions. Why this is important is because chronologically, those three generations take us through the period of the rightly guided caliphs of Abu Bakr, Umar, Uthman, and Ali, and it takes us through the first dynasty of Islam, the Umayyad dynasty. And at the end of that third generation is the rise of the Abbasid period. This is important because I've documented it. The period of the companions were largely black Arabs. The companions, the period, that first generation was a black generation. That the period of the rightly guided caliphs, all of the caliphs were black Arabs, Abu Bakr, Umar, Uthman, and Ali, black, bald, and potbelly. The Umayyad dynasty was that black power dynasty of which I spoke. That period embraces the three generations of which the prophet spoke. And those three generations were not just characterized by being black. They were characterized by championing God in the form of a man. Prophet Muhammad was clear. His God was a shaks, and shaks is an Arabic word that means man, a man with a body. The Umayyad, this understanding of God in the form of a man, was the state belief of the Umayyad dynasty. The Umayyad dynasty, the black dynasty. After that third generation, that Umayyad dynasty was overthrown by white Persians who had converted to Islam and hated black Arabs and hated their religion. They hated being ruled by black Arabs over in Khorasan, or what is now Iran or Persia. And they conspired
and converted to Islam.
They converted to Islam clandestinely. Their heart was with the religion of their fathers. The glorious Sasanian Empire was a Zoroastrian religion, and they described Zoroastrianism as the white religion because the Persians are proud Aryans. Persians are not Semites. And Persian, Farsi, is not a Semitic language. Persians are Aryan peoples, proud Aryan peoples. And so the Zoroastrians under Islamic rule distinguished, the Persians under Islamic rule distinguished their religion, Zoroastrianism, as the white religion versus the black religion, meaning Islam. They clandestinely converted to Islam, overthrew the black dynasty. But then they converted Islam to Zoroastrianism. They reshaped Islam in the image of the religion of their fathers, Zoroastrianism. So one characteristic difference
is whereas the black Umayyad champion of God, who had a physical form, that man God, the Abbasids rejected the God with the physical form, the man God, and they started championing the spook God, the God that has no form. So the theology changed. The legal principles changed. Islamic law, Islamic jurisprudence is now under the tutelage of white converts, Persians and Byzantines. The intellectual edifice is constructed by Persian converts, and they incorporated, for example, Arabic racism. You have hadiths talking about black folks that stink and Allah hates black folks, such that for every black person a Muslim kills, they get a blessing from Allah. Well, the Prophet Muhammad didn't say that. The Persians, who were responsible for so much of the hadith literature in the 9th century, they said that. So the changes that were brought into Islam after that third generation are actually very easy to identify. And the agents of the change are likewise very easy to identify.
Yes, sir. Okay, so Dr. Wesley, so exactly,
yes, ma'am.
In the most simplistic way, I guess, that you can put it, because I tried to study it myself, and it's very, very detailed, and it's a very long process to actually study and grasp the information, but as briefly as possible, what is it in particularly that was taken out of the hadith?
Well, it's not about what was necessarily taken out of the hadith. It's about hadith was fabricated. Hold on for 1 second.
Angel Islam, be a listener.
I'm sorry, I'm multitasking. Got to get my children ready for bed remotely. back on track. It's not about what was taken out of hadith. It's about hadith were fabricated in the name of Prophet Muhammad. It became easy. As it became necessary to attribute things to Prophet Muhammad in order to validate either a legal principle or a theological doctrine in particular. So there was a time period, particularly in the 8th and 9th century, where hadiths were fabricated all over the place. Any school of thought that wanted to get any measure of authority or popularity for its position had to anchor it in a statement from the Prophet Muhammad, in the authority of Prophet Muhammad, and that usually came by way of attributing to him confirmation of that later theological or legal principle. So hadith were fabricated all over the place. Now, Muslim scholars of the classical period tried to devise a way whereby they could distinguish the authentic, or what we call sound hadith, meaning the hadith that was actually representative of what the prophet said or did, versus false or unsound hadith, or da'if, unsound hadith, fabricated hadith. And that's how you get, you know, Bukhari and Muslim in these collections. And while as noble an endeavor as that was, every one of these compilers of the canonical or sacred or approved collection of hadith, every one of them were themselves motivated by theological, political, social, racial motivations which impacted their selection process. So you have fabricated hadith in Bukhari. You also have clearly sound hadith the Bukhari left out. So the process, even though the scholars tried to bring some order to what had become a very chaotic process of fabricating hadith everywhere and anywhere, the hadith scholars tried to bring some order to that. And for that, they are to be commended. But they did not succeed in totally distinguishing sound hadith versus false hadith. And this is to my Sunni family who may be listening in particular, they did not succeed in revealing what the sunnah or the way of the prophet is by compiling these six books of hadith. Those six books of hadith do not represent the sunnah, the totality of the sunnah of the prophet, nor do they, what they do represent, they don't represent that perfectly.
Yes, sir. Okay, so, you know, we're going to try to move quickly, and of course we want to give our listening audience an opportunity to ask questions as well. And I'm just going to ask you because, you know how sometimes we tell stories in the village and, you know, the community of the family, and we have so many versions, and we have this King James version of Christianity, and
yes,
I want to get back to the origin of the idea of slavery, because I remember my father telling me that in Africa, if you were enslaved, you were enslaved by class and not by color. Of course, he, of course, him being Muslim, he knew that, you know, the black man was the original man. So the idea of slavery, as far as our people, where did that come from?
Well, I think it would be presumptuous for anyone to presume, except they get it from divine revelation, it would be presumptuous for anyone to presume they've identified the origin of any idea. I can't offer that, but I can offer this, however. One, you are right to point out that there was slavery in Africa. Slavery did not begin with the white man and our Holocaust of enslavement here in the West. This slavery, of course, was very different from the slavery that we've known, one of the differences being color-based. But in terms of the origin of slavery, while I can't answer that, in terms of the origin of the idea of slavery, I can say that based on my research, slavery among us seems to have begun as a humane alternative to the consequences of war. There's a time when during war, the loser was just killed. The idea at some point came about, whether through revelation or otherwise, just an epiphany, that it was more humane to not kill the losers in the war. But what are you to do with them? This is the aftermath of a war. So prisoners of war were reduced to slavery rather than being killed. And it can be argued that that is a more humane consequence for the aftermath of war. Some may argue, whatever the case, we had slavery. But slavery with us versus indentured servitude, slavery with us was largely a consequence of war's loss. And it was more often than not the more humane alternative to the standard consequences
of war. So that's my understanding of the development of the institution of slavery among African peoples around the world. And again, you are correct in distinguishing that from what whites practice here, which was a more severe, there was no humanity in the institution at all, and it was race-based, racial slavery.
Yes.
While not new to white Americans, it distinguishes white American slavery. Yes, sir.
And we're going to give, excuse me.
Let's see. All right, Dr. West, well, Sister Gidget,
okay.
Get yourself back together.
I'm sorry. I'm ready to cover for my sister.
I did a whole 2-hour show with the code coughing and hacking. I can't even go back and listen to that show. Nah, I'm just embarrassed.
Oh, my God. Well, I want to see if there's if anyone has a question in the chat room. I see my sister Michelle. I see my brother Akbar, my brother Donald out there. I see some familiar numbers on here. So if you have a question now, go ahead, because we have like 1 hour and 7 minutes, and we have a lot of questions for Dr. Wesley, but I want to give you all an opportunity. So if anyone has a question in the next 5 minutes or so, it's a good time to ask a question. But I'm going to ask you one more question, Dr. Wesley.
Yes, ma'am.
And I wanted to ask, I wanted to start the conversation on culture, because I did want to cover those 5 areas in the title. We're covering history, culture, faith, hell, and victory. I want to start the conversation on culture, and I want to start by understanding, since we have been so removed spiritually and mentally and culturally from our original selves, what is it that you discovered about the culture of our people and how we actually lived and worked together in a civilized manner? Of course, we all know that there were wars and there were differences between tribes and territory and things like that. But as in our own nature, not this, you know, extracted shell that we're living in now, how did we live with one another and what was our culture?
Well, I think the most important thing that I learned is the implications of the Honorable Elijah Muhammad informing us that we are the Asiatic black man, meaning we are a global people. I learned that we have a cultural symphony, no different or no less than we have a chromatic symphony or symphony of complexions. I learned that one of the most important things I learned is what I call the tyranny of black hegemonies, or the tyranny of African hegemonies, by which I mean this. There are people who would have us believe that there is only one African culture, one paradigm of African culture, and anything that deviates from that is non-African. And they tend to, that paradigm, that one paradigm of African culture tends to be an artificial construct of that person. And like a tyrant, they try to impose that paradigm of African culture on everybody who would want to claim to be African. But the tyranny of African hegemonies. Well, anyone who is remotely familiar with global African culture knows first that we are different all over the world. There is commonalities across the planet.
But the differences, the divergences for me are as important as the commonality, because it speaks to the genius and the godhood of the black man and woman. We are not a monolithic people culturally. We are not a monolithic people spiritually. You have, for example, in Africa, one of the myths of Afrocentricity is that African religion is characterized, for example, by a matriarchy, woman ruled, or a mother goddess, whereas the white man's religion is that which is characterized by patriarchy, or a man god. And so if your religion, Muslims, has a male god, then you have a non-African religion, because African religions are characterized by matriarchy. Well, that's an Afrocentric myth. There are matriarchal religious traditions in Africa, indigenous to Africa. But there are equal or more patriarchal religious traditions in Africa. And when we go beyond the continent of Africa, as we should as Asiatic black men, and go into Papua New Guinea, go into the other isles of the Pacific, go into India, go into Suma, when we take the Asiatic black man into account, meaning the global black man into account, then we see that there, while there was profound theological commonality, cultural commonality, there are variations that should be respected and honored. Just like, and I think that's an important principle for us in the mosque. Right? We in the mosque, in the Nation of Islam, we have become monolithic tyrants like that. Right? We, in our process of becoming a cult of personality, which we have, we want everybody, we expect everybody to sound the same, to articulate this teaching the same way, to have the same understanding of this teaching, by which I mean not the understanding that the Honorable Mr. Louis Farrakhan has given us. What he has made clear, he has made clear. But we have, there are many of us who we study ourselves and we have our own understanding, which is a good thing, but then we suppose that every Muslim should have the understanding that we've acquired through our idiosyncratic study. And so we are making the Nation of Islam a monolith, and we don't respect the diversity of Muslims in the nation.
Come on.
And that is one of the reasons we have flatlined. And that is one lesson that if we were students of history, and the Christ told us that of all of our studies, history is most attractive and best qualified to reward our research. Had we been more studious, we would have been able to avoid that trap, because God, even though all we get in the Quran is Allah, God as Allah, his universal name, but the fact of the matter is, as the Honorable Elijah Muhammad told us, the Allah that put the sun in the sky was not the same Allah that put the moon in the sky. And they had their own distinct idiosyncratic way. The 13 tribes that came with the planet Earth, they weren't all the same. There's wisdom in the fact that it's impossible for all the people to speak the same dialect. The very construction of nature prohibits the totality of the black nation from speaking the same dialect. That means variation in our culture, variation in our way is a natural thing. So I went on this, I got on the soapbox, forgive me, in answer to your question about an African culture, because that's part of, that's a misnomer. There's African cultures, and even with Islam, when the culture of the world was Islam. Islam was articulated, was lived in ways different, for example, in India than in Arabia. I'm not talking about the Indians that got kicked out in exile because they violated Islam, but the Indians that did the exiling, they weren't necessarily, their culture was not the same as the culture in Arabia or in China. Their dialects weren't different. So the symphony of cultures is as important to respect and acknowledge as is the symphony of complexions. And that's true not just globally, but that's true in our nation of Islam.
Yes, sir. Wow. Okay, we have one question from the chat room, and this is from Brother Akbar Muhammad. I don't know what city he's from. He said, what is the origin of Arabic, and what is ancient Egyptian Arabic?
Yes, sir. Well, ancient Egyptian Arabic is what the Most Honorable Elijah Muhammad said Moses or Musa spoke. I cannot say any more of that because the Honorable Elijah Muhammad didn't give us any more of that, and there's no way we can study the language of Musa. We have nothing to go on. No, the Torah, as we have it, even though it's called the books of Moses, Moses didn't write that book. So studying the biblical Hebrew doesn't in and of itself give us much insight into what Musa's or Moses's ancient Egyptian Arabic may have looked like. The origin of Arabic. Arabic is a Semitic language. It's part of the Semitic linguistic group. Semitic language of families. The Semitic language of families itself is part of a larger linguistic group called Afroasiatic, which originated in East Central Africa. The Semitic languages originated in Africa and traveled to Arabia in the East. So Arabic is an African language. Its first speakers were what linguists call Proto-Semites, or the Proto-Semitic language, meaning the language presumed to have been spoken by that first group of Semites is separated from the larger group of Afroasiatic speakers in Africa. That group spoke a Proto-Semitic language, and all of the linguistic evidence gives us reason to believe that that so-called Proto-Semitic language was very near to Arabic, that Arabic is the best representative of that Proto-Semitic language. So in terms of the origin of Arabic as we know it, it derived from a group of Africans roughly 7,000 to 8,000 years ago who descended the Nile Valley, crossed over the Red Sea into Arabia.
Yes, sir. Okay, I'm going to turn it over to Brother Vernon and see if he has a question.
Yes, sir, brother. One question that came up a while ago in your in what you were saying. Since you touched on Africa, there's so many people who like to focus on ancient Egypt as, you know, the end-all, be-all, or the ultimate in
the pyramidian
civilization.
The pyramidian.
You are qualified to say that and back that up. I'm not going to say it like that, brother. I don't have my tights and my cape, so I ain't going to go out there like that. But if you would you speak about some of the other civilizations in Africa and speak on, just like you did with Egypt, speak on how Islam showed up in those ancient civilizations?
Yes, sir. Well, first let me qualify. Those of our people who study Kemet are doing right. I, too, study Kemet.
Kemet or Egypt should be, must be studied. Any thorough knowledge of self must include a thorough study of and knowledge of ancient Kemet. So when I say pyramidians, I'm not referring to Kemetologists or students of Kemet. I am a Kemetologist. I am a student of Kemet. And I say unashamedly, frequently, that my Islam is Ma'adic Islam. I explain that in my new book, Egyptian Sacred Science in Islam, what I mean by Ma'adic Islam. A lot of Muslims, both in the mosque, in the nation, and other Muslims don't like that, but I don't lose any sleep over what those don't like or even do like. But I say that to clarify. The pyramidiot are those of whom you correctly spoke of, Brother Vernon. Those who believe Africanity starts and stops with Kemet. Those who don't believe black folks did anything worth talking much about other than Kemet. Those who believe all that Kemet defines what blackness is, it defines what African is. Part, and they tend to be guilty of what I just spoke of, the tyranny of African hegemonies. Those who, they construct their African paradigm based totally on Kemet. And everything is about Kemet. As if we didn't build glorious civilization in India, which has a lot to tell us about Africanness. As if we didn't build glorious cultural civilization even in Europe before the white man got there. So-called old Europe was black Europe. And we built glorious civilization in old Europe before we ran the white man to the caves there, and he was able to descend the caves and experience and witness our civilization in Europe, co-opt some of it, and destroy much of it. So the civilizations of Africa before or other than Kemet, I would, if I may, rather speak of the civilizations of Asia. By Asia, meaning the planet Earth, the 496,940,000 square miles. It's just important that we get to and stay at the global perspective of our culture. Now, regarding the continent of Africa, Kemet is the most glorious piece of civilization in Africa. It wasn't the beginning. There was civilization, prior civilization in Nubia. There's prior civilization in southern Africa. Granted, none of them achieved the material political greatness that Kemet did. It is the height of civilization on that continent. However, the civilization of Africa, meaning the planet Earth, the black man established, there we, when the Nile Valley was a home to Neolithic cultures, right? Cultures long before they acquired the skill to build pyramids or sacred tombs, when the Nile Valley hosted hunters and gatherers around 7,000 BC over in Turkey, black folks had established a city, a bona fide stone city, Shatal Huzuk, which was at that time a supernova in terms of its luminosity. This is 3,000 to 4,000 years before similar developments occurred in the Nile Valley. So we cannot. It's now been discovered the fabled city of Ubar, or
the Quran calls the City of Pillars. It was this fabled city in Arabia that was supposedly destroyed. Well, that fabled city has now been discovered by NASA scientists, buried under the desert of Central Arabia. And so that civilization in Arabia goes back thousands of years and was contemporary with Kemet at its height. So the black man and woman have shown our civilizational skills in a myriad of ways across the world. And I will keep returning to the diversity which Allah blessed us with. See, the Quran says, Allah says that He created the races, right? That we won't, that we may know each other. He created the colors, that we may know each other, not despise each other. See, diversity is God ordained.
Come on.
A diversity that's important, you know, a lot of the, some of the pyramidiots for whom it's all about Kemet, one thing they tend to do is misrepresent Kemet. And thus, their African paradigm that they tyrannically impose, try to impose on others, it's an artificial paradigm. It doesn't much resemble reality, African reality. But one of the things that's often said is, you know, I'm not religious, I'm spiritual. The African people aren't religious people. We're spiritual people, and they point to Kemet. Well, two things. One, they're absolutely wrong. There is, when Herodotus said, the great author said that the Egyptians were the most religious people on the earth, that white boy never lied. There is no religiosity of the ancient world that can compare to the religiosity, the organized religiosity in Kemet. Now, they would have done better if they invoked not Kemet. Those who want to say they're not religious, they're spiritual, they're not beholden, and they don't involve themselves with religious institutions, organized religion. But Kemet was pure religion. It was staunchly organized in its religion. But over in Black India, it was very theological, but we don't have the religious apparatus in Indus Valley civilization than we have in Kemetic civilization. So here was a black civilization that had the truth of God. It was a God-based civilization, but it did not have all the religious bureaucracy that characterized Kemet. So this is a diversity that black folks offer the world. So, you know, we offer the world in many ways a smorgasbord. Take your pick. All of it is African. Huh? The Indus Valley is less African than Kemet. So if you want to be very organized in your religious expression, well, that's African, and you can look to Kemet as your example. If you want to be God-centered but less bureaucratically religious, well, that's African too. You can point to India. So the black man is the Asiatic black man. And our Asiaticness, our globalness, produce the symphony, the symphonies that we've given to the world, and we should celebrate them and not deny them or act as if they're a bad thing.
Yes, sir.
Well,
okay.
In what you're saying, and I don't mean to monopolize the conversation, Sister Gidget, but in what you're saying, and in the way that you answered one of the previous questions, you know, about what signs to look for as we're reading the history, it's encapsulated in my mind that we got to begin thinking outside the box.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir.
Absolutely.
Yes, sir. Absolutely. A box is a prison.
That's
box is a prison. We think
we know who constructed that box. And we Muslims like to think that the box in which we live and imprison ourselves is a box constructed by Master Farouk Muhammad, the Honorable Elijah Muhammad, the Honorable Mr. Louis Farrakhan, when in reality, for most of us, the box is self-constructed. It's a box of our own idiosyncratic understanding of the teachings, which is fine because we all have them. But when we are unable to recognize that our box is our own construction, what we have is our own understanding of the teaching that may or may not be right, if we recognize that, then be willing to step outside that box if compelled to do so by data or better information or a more sound, logical understanding of the teaching.
Yes, sir. Boy, you teaching hard up in here, Dr. Wesley. All right.
Inshallah.
Okay, listen, we have a question from the person who calls themselves Southern Mind in the chat room. And he or she says, the Honorable Elijah Muhammad teaches that the white race was manufactured on the island of Patmos or Palan. Has Dr. Wesley come across any information in his research about that island? I went to college, but I can't pronounce this word. I'm going to try to corroborate this saying a degree. It's two words I couldn't say. That one and message. It took me a long time. So, okay, Dr. Dr. Wesley.
Well, in terms of the history of the birth of the Caucasian, via Yaqub in the process as outlined by the Honorable Elijah Muhammad. Yes, in fact, there is great evidence. In fact, the ancient records bear wonderful witness to this truth for the Honorable Elijah Muhammad. If you're asking about information regarding the island of Palan or Patmos in particular, I have not. I know colleagues who have visited Patmos and have gone with the teachings of the Honorable Elijah Muhammad in mind, looking for evidence. I have not had the opportunity to have a detailed dialogue with them to see what they have found regarding the island. So I cannot say anything regarding the island itself. But in terms of the history of Yaqub and the making of the white man, absolutely. In fact, I would say this, the Aryans who went up in India, the root of modern Hindu civilization, those Aryans who went up in India around 2000 BC and caused so much death and destruction in their literature, they have the history of their god Yaqub and their making by him. So yes, there is practically all of the major teachings of the Honorable Elijah Muhammad have empirical corroboration. In 2012, it takes more blind faith to disbelieve in the teachings of the Honorable Elijah Muhammad that it takes us to believe in the teachings of the Honorable Elijah Muhammad, because there's so much corroborative evidence for all of the major teachings of the Most Honorable Elijah Muhammad, including Yaqub and his making of devil.
Yes, sir. Okay, we kind of covered culture, and, you know, so basically what I gather is it just depends on what region of the world, what part of the world we were in. We had different cultures. And
yes,
so, but one thing we know for sure, though, that what we have here is not our natural culture. We can verify that. Absolutely.
Yes, we can. Absolutely. Absolutely.
So, you know, Dr. Wesley, It was some time ago, and, you know, I was one of them people who had a very closed mind about the church, not church, church. And
yes,
growing up Muslim, you know, you have a tendency to do that. But I remember one of my family members saying about Corinthians and some of the disciples and, like, Peter and Paul and Timothy and some other people, how they actually went out and kind of like, and I'm not sure if I'm even accurate, but kind of like divided the church, so to speak. And so we as a people are divided by religion, are divided by faith. And my question back then was, well, if everyone says they're a Christian, why do we have First Baptist, Second Baptist, you know, Methodist, Lutheran, Catholic, you know, why we have all these different things? Because growing up in the nation, you went to the temple. And everybody went to the temple. So I was, you know, I didn't understand. And so I want to know, what has been the impact on our society in America brought by that division of faith and the, I don't like to say lies, but the revisions of the scriptures in the Bible, because clearly those scriptures have been, you know, revised, books have been separated. We know, we as Muslims know that. A lot of Christians may not acknowledge that, but that's just the actual fact. Hey, I'm just giving it to you like it is, take it or leave it alone. But, you know, how has that really impacted us as a people in America, and how can we close that gap?
Yes, ma'am. Well, the division caused by religion is most unfortunate, most detrimental, especially to black folks. Now, religious division, we black folks here in America did not offer religious division. White folks are divided religiously. In fact, most of our church divisions we inherited from white folks. But white folks do church division a little better than do religious division a little better than we do religious division. They certainly do church division a little better than we do church division. We just got this gang bang mentality. We set trip with ours in a way more than white folks. And white folks are more practical. They're able to put those aside for the common good. There is no greater example, the common good of whitehood. There is no greater example of that than this recent presidential campaign. Romney is a Mormon. And the Mormon Church, the Church of Latter-day Saints, was in many ways the Nation of Islam of white folks. The Church of Latter-day Saints was, by all accounts, by all Christian accounts, a cult. They talk about, white folks talk about and characterize the Church of Latter-day Saints the way they characterize the Nation of Islam. But Christians don't recognize the Church of Latter-day Saints as Christian. They recognize it as a cult. They mock it. Fundamentalist Christians have a field day warring ideologically, preaching against the Church of Latter-day Saints. But they were able to close ranks with that Mormon for the preservation of white supremacy in the United States, to get their white country back from this black man. And so you got fundamentalist Christians
that jumped on the Mitt Romney campaign. Those who are students of religion, especially American religion, and know the Church of Latter-day Saints and how it is bashed by mainstream Christianity, those persons know and look, as I look, aghast at how these fundamentalist Christian whites were able to close ranks with Mitt Romney, the Mormon. Why? Because they saw the bigger picture. And the bigger picture was the death of white Americans, the death of white supremacy, what they feared, white supremacy in America. So that was a wonderful example of how white folks, when it's time to set those religious differences aside, regardless of how entrenched those religious differences are, they know how to put that stuff aside for the common good, the good of white people. Black folks have yet to learn that skill or grow to that maturity.
Right, and you know, but the heartbreaking thing about it, though, Dr. Wesley, is that the preachers, you know, whatever they call themselves, they sometimes, and I'm not speaking about all preachers, and I'm certainly not putting down Christianity, don't get that idea in your head, and I'm talking to my listening audience, but some of the preachers actually will get up and speak against Minister Farrakhan. However, if you look at the track record of Minister Farrakhan, he has always demonstrated his desire to unify with black people. And he didn't say he wanted to unify with black Muslims, Sunni, Orthodox. He said black people, Catholic, Lutheran, Christianity, whatever you are. And we have preachers that get up and speak out against Minister Farrakhan. However, you and I know, and a lot of the believers know, that the method of operation that the Nation of Islam is now implementing for our condition to be improved, and we now having to really depend on ourselves, we have to get out of the mindset of that, you know, created prejudice that is embedded within us in order for us to go out and get our people. And it's so disheartening, because when Minister Farrakhan goes to the street, those people that are running up to him, greeting him, happy to see him, those are not members of the Nation of Islam.
Right. No, man.
These are the same people that they do not go out and pursue themselves, and they love our ministers. So I'm saying that at some point we have to go out and really talk at the table, you know, with the preachers and with the deacons and with the people who are having influence in the religious institutions to pull our people together, because pulling us apart is going to get us killed, bottom line.
Yes,
and I just want to know how you feel about that, Dr. Wesley.
I feel how you feel. I couldn't have said it better than you, Sister Gidget. I would add that the problem is compounded with us in the scenario that you outlined with the preachers, because you also had the problem of jealousy and envy. A lot of that hate, a lot of the rejection of the Honorable Minister Louis Farrakhan by preachers is jealousy and envy. There is no more compelling religious leader, quote unquote, in America, black America or white America, than the Honorable Minister Louis Farrakhan. And the church has always been a stage with a big spotlight. And people aspire to the pulpit in a black church just as people aspire to be rappers on a stage or actors on television. And so when a man like Farrakhan, whose light is dazzling and undeniable, it's going to produce the type of pushback, the envy and jealousy that unfortunately he experiences from a lot of the black clergy. They're afraid that Farrakhan will take a large portion of their following and they will lose their church, they'll lose money. The other thing is, we have to realize, we in the Nation of Islam, to one extent, we have to be understanding with them because they don't have what we have. What we have is an exceptional human being. I love the way Dr. Ridgely put it. Farrakhan is that new human being. See, when Farrakhan preaches unity, it's very genuine with him. He means it. And he puts forth every effort to achieve it, even by taking losses himself. The integrity of Farrakhan, the character of Farrakhan, is very distinct. And so, no, these other churches are led by a man, the likes of Farrakhan. And so, for us to expect them to respond in the genuine way to the call of unity, as the minister does, well, in a sense, we're asking too much of them. But they have not grown to that new humanhood that Farrakhan is growing us into, inshallah, but that Farrakhan has achieved. So on one level, we need to recognize that, you know, we lament the jealousy and envy that is at the root of much of the rejection of our minister by the black clergy. On the other hand, we just understand that it's, on one sense, not their fault. We have, we are led by our example is an exceptional human being. And those out there aren't similarly exceptional human beings. So for us to expect them to be exceptional, to act exceptional, which is what it would take for them to genuinely reach out to us in light of the tradition of the division caused by the white man here in America, for the purpose of preserving white supremacy. On one level, it's unfortunate, jealousy and envy, but on the other level, I understand it. They haven't grown to that exceptional humanhood that it would take for them to really be genuine in the efforts to cross these bridges.
Yes, sir. Okay, I'm going to let Brother Vernon ask a question, and then we have a question out of the chat room because we're down to like 27 minutes or so. So, Brother Vernon, if you have a question for Dr. Wesley.
Brother, I don't have a question for you. I have a comment, though.
Yes,
and I guess it goes back to that initial question that I asked. I don't know why Allah is putting that on my heart so much, but as I'm listening to you, I'm hearing all the different qualities and aspects of what we're going through now that mirror, our history and our past.
Yes, sir.
And just the example that you just gave of where Minister Farrakhan is and his expression of what he knows and what he believes, and how in any given city, he'll come to our city where we are, represent, go and, make friends with whoever he makes friends with.
Yes.
And then he leaves us here to follow in his footsteps.
Yes, sir.
And, as clear as day with the example that he sets. I think that is such a lesson and a turning point right there, how we handle our people, no matter what school of thought they're in, no matter what church, what group they're in, we know that we have something of value for an audience to listen to. And how we are received by our audience really is our responsibility. We see how he moves, how he operates, and we see how he chooses to use language in a particular way so that who he's talking to understands exactly what he's talking about.
Yes, sir.
And that is what gets him through to their hearts.
Absolutely.
That question that I asked, you know, where did they lose that power? Where did they step away from that? So every time Sister Gidget opens her mouth and says something and you come up with an answer, it just shows me another aspect. Shows me another aspect of what we need to reclaim our grip on and start walking this walk the right way. So I thank you for what you're saying. I'm taking it to heart, brother.
Oh, I thank you, and you spoke wisely there, Brother Vernon. Praise be to Allah. Yes, sir.
I do have one question for you. A question was just raised, actually. A person shot me a message. Question is, where do you think your research and findings could be placed into the current curriculum within our educational system in and out of the Nation of Islam to create a new world of thinking?
Was that going to be your question?
Yes, that was my next question, as a matter of fact. We're working on that. I did discuss with the Honorable Mr. Louis Farrakhan with me. Rewriting, participating in the restructuring of the curriculum of MUI. I put together a curriculum, a course curriculum, already for MUI, and these efforts will continue and broaden because we do need to rewrite, tighten up our curriculum and incorporate this new material. It verifies and validates and shines light on the teachings of Honorable Elijah Muhammad incorporated in the curriculum. So that endeavor is ongoing. It has begun. And inshallah, we will see the fruits of it soon.
Wonderful.
Yes, sir. Praise be to Allah. Okay, we're going to take a question from... I think this is Southern Mind again. It said, what would Dr. Wesley consider one of his most surprising or greatest findings during his years of study to validate the teachings? That's something which gave him goosebumps and made the hair stand up on the back of his neck.
Wow.
But you know, actually, I can answer that question. I distinctly remember, even though if I was to actually think long and hard, I could probably come up with two or three, maybe four or five, maybe 10 or 12, quite frankly. I've been academically studying the teaching for 22 years now. It has been... And my passion is no less today than it was 22 years ago, because it's as exciting to me, this discovery. Studying this teaching academically is as fulfilling, rewarding, and exciting for me as it was 22 years ago. But as you were reading that question, the first thing that came to mind, I think one of the first... hair, back of the neck hair moments for me was one day I remember hearing the minister give a lecture, 1984, Gary, Indiana, Vegas Day, 1984, Gary, Indiana.
Uh-huh.
And he spoke about Pope Pius XII and the body of Jesus embalmed in Jerusalem. And that piqued my interest. And I remember I was at the time listening to the tape. I had to have been a freshman at Morehouse, made my first year at Morehouse. And I didn't know what I was looking for. I didn't know what direction, but I remember spending hours going through microfiche at the library.
Mm-hmm.
And then it came across that microfiche screen, a New York Times article, body of Pope embalmed with method used to embalm the body of Jesus. And when the article was about when Pope Pius XII had died, his body was embalmed with the method that was used to embalm the body of Jesus. And the New York Times just put it out there that the body of Jesus was embalmed and the Pope's body was embalmed in a similar way. You know, just absolutely confirming what the Honorable Elijah Muhammad had said, that Jesus didn't die and his body came back to life. His body was embalmed and it's on the earth today. And I remember when that article, I had no idea. I didn't know what I was looking for. I certainly didn't know what I would encounter, but when that came through that microfiche on that, I still remember the hair on the back of my neck standing up. So that's one example of a discovery. Here is the New York Times confirming, and I said something seemingly so outrageous, the Honorable Elijah Muhammad said, that Jesus' body was embalmed. So that was one of the first beautiful finds for me, and it made my hair on the back of my neck stand up. And it happens still to this day, I promise you, 22 years later, it still happens.
Well, I can tell you that being in this nation for 46 years and being able to bear witness to many things that I heard as a child from the mouth of the Honorable Elijah Muhammad and see them coming to fruition is you can't even put a title on it. It's just more than amazing. It's just, hey, bear witness and knowing that you're in the right place. Now, we have a few minutes. We don't have any questions right now, but I want to thank all of my faithful listening audience from Atlanta, Mississippi. I see you out there. Oh, God, there's some more area codes on here. I'm not familiar with y'all, but I love y'all, and thank y'all for calling in and listening. And I know Dr. West is answering everybody's questions, so they don't have any hands up right now. But I want to talk about something real quick. We have about 17 minutes. And the state that we're in today, you know, the shrinking job market, the lack of health care, the high incarceration rate, the 72% of black women giving birth unwed. And now a study that I have been working on about the astronomical amount of black male prisoners going into prison, HIV negative, coming out of prison, HIV positive.
Yes, ma'am.
When we talk about separation, Dr. Wesley, we have heard these teachings for over 80 years, and if you get a few of our veterans in, like Brother Jamil and, you know, my minister, Southwest Regional Minister Robert Muhammad, Minister Tony Muhammad out of 27, if you get, you know, all of them together, you get 100-plus years of history and experience all in one in this nation. So we've had these teachings, and it's past time, in my opinion, that we really talk about and be about the separation.
Yes,
but
ma'am.
Even though we've had these teachings, the application of these teachings have been proven to be most difficult, and the most difficult process is the unification. So I'm asking you, as one of the most remarkable scholars that we've ever had in the Nation of Islam, sir, I'm asking you, in your opinion, how do we start this process of the unification of like minds to actually bring into fruition that territory of our own?
Yes, ma'am. Wonderful question. You raised the critical issue, separation. But separation must start with us here in the Nation of Islam, by which I mean the scripture says, no, we are commanded to be in the world, but not of the world. You know, the scripture says, come out of her, my people, be not partakers in her sins. That first moral, spiritual, cultural, intellectual separation from this world was a prerequisite to our physical separation. Well, we in the Nation of Islam, we need to separate from the world. We have, in a very real sense, Sister Gidget, have conformed to the world. Paul said, be not conformed to this world, but be ye transformed by the renewing of your mind. Well, in a very real sense, we in the Nation of Islam have conformed to the world. We have not been transformed into the mind of Christ. One of the key illustrations of that is what I call, for example, the hip-hopization of the Nation of Islam. There was a time when the rappers looked to us with awe. With the Nation of Islam, the Muslims, where folks who were looked at by everyone else as celebrities, they looked at us like that. We were their leaders, and they did their best, as best they could, to mimic us, to follow our example. But then the roles were reversed. Now Muslims are in awe of the rappers, and we are following them and our culture instead of their culture being impacted by us. Our culture is impacted by them. And so we need to come out of her, my people, be not partakers in her way. When we conform to this world's way, that's when we lost our life, Sister Gideon. And we have lost our life. We have not been the beacon of light in a black community. Farrakhan has, but
yes,
we,
sir,
the Nation of Islam, has not. We, in as Muslims on the street, have not been, because we have become enamored in this world. We are in awe of them instead of them being in awe of us. We are the possessors of supreme wisdom. The seventh seal has been revealed, has been broken and revealed unto us. So it's right that our people are in awe of us. We are possessors of supreme wisdom. So it's an unnatural state of affairs that rappers are leading us culturally rather than us leading them. And that's just an example of how we have been conformed. And so separation, the prerequisite for physical separation, has to reoccur with us. We have to culturally disengage America, including black America. See, the Honorable Elijah Muhammad redefined black culture, and the community outside the nation followed suit. Now
our culture and the nation has been defined by black cultural trends, and that's a problem. We need to separate, disengage America, black and white America, culturally. Reestablish our culture, and then we can talk about separation and lead our people to a physical separation after we have led them to a cultural separation.
Yes, sir. Okay, now that was somebody logging in. All right, we about at the 10-minute mark. If anyone in the listening audience has a question for Dr. Wesley, raise your hand now. Press 1 on your phone keypad. If not, we're going to move on. One more question, Dr. Wesley. I want to, if you don't mind, sir, would you elaborate on your intentions for the Truth Institute? I know that's a project that you have been working on, that you're in the process of bringing into fruition. I would like for you to explain, your purpose and let us know as well what we can possibly do to help you, since 9 times out of 10, which I know we're going to be the beneficiaries of it. So if you would, enlighten us, please, sir.
That's right. Truth of God Institute, TGI, was an institute I began establishing a few years back, the idea of which was to institutionalize this material. The fundamental aim of Truth of God Institute was to study the mother of all questions, who is God, from every conceivable angle, but from the purely academic, scientific perspective. So the vision of TGI will be the institute wherein the truth of God is studied, is explored, is approached with the highest level of academic and scientific rigor. And so that is still in process, inshallah. It will continue to grow. And, for example, one agenda item would be to hold seminars, academic seminars, on various aspects of the truth of God. The hope is to help, you see, for most black people, religion is not an intellectual experience. It's a purely emotional experience. And that is detrimental, in my opinion, to this whole religious enterprise. The truth of God is, the question, who is God, is an awesome question. And answering it, or the attempt to answer it, the very attempt to answer it in a methodical way, in a responsible way, will bear so much fruit for the researcher. Pursuing that question in a scientific and academic manner will bear so much fruit. And the reason that's important, I firmly believe, Sister Gidget, that unless we get God right, we can't do life right. And so there is no more important question to be fully vetted than the question, who is God? There's no issue that more urgently needs to be approached by the best minds with the best tools at the highest level of rigor than the truth of God. And that's what I hope to engage in through Truth of God Institute.
Okay. Thank you, Dr. Wesley. And we have a question. So, Caesar, would you open up the question from, I know that's a Georgia number, 678?
Pastor Maven, can you hear me?
Walaikum
salam. Who's calling? And what city are you calling from?
Well, right now I'm in Laredo, Texas. I'm from Atlanta. This is Brother You God Allah.
Oh, peace Allah.
Walaikum salam.
Brother You God, peace God. How you be?
I'm all wise and civilized. How about yourself, brother? How's your family?
Wise and civilized, hopefully wise.
Yes, sir.
Hopefully getting wiser by the day. But I can vouch for the civilization aspect. I am confident I'm civilized, great God.
Yes, sir. Of course, one of your favorite quotes, one of my favorite quotes is, you know, if you can't do God right, you can't do life right. That leads to a question that came in my head about the spiritual boot camp. And would it be any of those anytime soon? And can you elaborate on that for those who are tuning in on that?
Yes, sir. The spiritual boot camp is a powerful brainchild of your big brother, Sister Gidget, and my big brother. Brother Minister Robert Muhammad there in Houston.
Yes, sir.
He spearheaded and put together the spiritual boot camp with myself, Brother Minister Anthony out of Memphis, Brother Dimitri out of Memphis. And it's a team. We come together and present the evidences for in defense of and in vindication of point number 12, and it's a spiritual boot camp because the Honorable Mr. Louis Farrakhan informed us that upon his departure, the Muslim world will war with us on that point number 12. They will seek to break our foundation, break our belief in point number 12. So this is war. Point number 12 is a clarion call. Is a war cry. And so the spiritual boot camp, the idea is to help strengthen the foundation of the believers, strengthen our faith in point number 12 in preparation for the tsunami of propaganda that will come from the Muslim world. So every year at Savior's Day, we've been blessed to hold the spiritual boot camp. We've held it in separately in Houston and in Philadelphia. Brother Minister Rodney Muhammad, my big brother out in Philadelphia, top of the clock, posted it there. We may hold it Savior's Day this year. I would assume that we will. I have not gotten information as of yet, but that's a little early. So I'm assuming we're going to hold the spiritual boot camp again at Savior's Day. And whatever city wants to bring us, they can contact Brother Minister Robert Muhammad and make it happen.
Okay, so thank you for calling in, brother. And we're going to mute your phone because I think we're getting some feedback. But thank you for the question. We have one more question, then we're going to have to go. 678-770. Are you there? Is that Brother Jahad?
Yes. No, this is Brother Seven Truth Allah.
Oh, peace, God. How you been?
Peace, great God. Yes, I'm hearing you speak on the spiritual boot camp, and I know that a few weeks ago you were able to speak from Mount Miriam about your experience at a particular spiritual boot camp, which you attended or actually did some lecturing at or something, and I want to understand what exactly is the spiritual boot camp, because me and Brother You guys speak on it a few times, but I'm not sure I understand what exactly is it. If you could elaborate.
Yes, sir. Beloved, did you hear my last response to Brother Yuga?
I heard some of it, yes. I was trying to get my phone off of mute and log in.
Yes, sir. Well, praise the Lord. As I stated to Brother Yuga, the spiritual boot camp is